Welcome to the Data Monitor Healthcare Podcast, where we dive into the latest developments in healthcare and medicine. I'm Emma.
And I'm Flora. This month, we have some exciting new content lined up. The CNS team, including my co-host Emma, attended the American Academy of Neurology Conference in Denver, Colorado. Today, we have Wenyu, Summer, and Joseph joining us from that team to share highlights from the conference and discuss some of the recent developments across multiple neurological disorders.
Yeah, so the conference covered a wide range of neurological conditions, including neurodegenerative diseases like ALS, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis, as well as migraine, different epilepsies, stroke, and a bunch of others. So we'll be hitting some key points over the course of this episode, but if our listeners are interested in more comprehensive coverage, our team has produced a full post-conference report, which will be available through the BioMedTracker report library probably in May.
Great. So I heard that Dr. Sanjay Gupta spoke at AAN this year.
Yeah, he did. One of the plenary sessions started off with an interview-style discussion titled Brain Health for All, which is arguably a great encapsulation of some of the key themes at AAN this year. As a CNN correspondent and a practicing neurosurgeon, among other roles, Dr. Gupta really drove home the importance of science communication that is accessible to the masses, empowering people to make informed decisions about their own health. He also talked about how many of our studies lack equity across diverse populations, which directly contributes to health illiteracy. However, what I found most interesting, though, was the idea that we live in more of a sick care system than a healthcare system. We don't typically do anything for our brains until something goes wrong. Although he references five pillars of brain health, Dr. Gupta highlighted just one of them, emphasizing sleep as a way to maintain and take care of our brains. Although there was a bit of Max exodus from the theater after Gupta finished, the speaker that followed, Dr. Macon Niedergaard, expanded upon the actual mechanics behind the importance of sleep, which is allowing the brain to dispose of protein waste through the glymphatic system. Since many neurodegenerative diseases are characterized by an inability to get rid of protein accumulation, it's possible that low-grade accumulation over decades, potentially due to not enough sleep, increases the likelihood of developing a neurodegenerative condition. But then, of course, the question becomes whether or not this is just a product of aging or if this is actually a waste management issue. It was super interesting.
That sounds super interesting. To think just getting a bit more sleep each night might have such an impact on our long-term health. Sounds like it was an excellent session. Now let's move on to multiple sclerosis, which had quite a bit of coverage at AAN this year. Joseph, can you give us an overview of MS and some of the highlights from that conference?
Absolutely. AAN covers a wide spectrum of neurological disorders, among which MS is extensively covered. Multiple sclerosis is widely recognized as the most common neurological and inflammatory disorder of the central nervous system in the adult population. It is a chronic, recurrent, progressive autoimmune disorder characterized by repeated episodes of inflammation of the white matter nervous tissue of the CNS. Now, the location of the inflammation varies from person to person and also from episode to episode, and as such results in a variety of clinical symptoms. There are three main types of MS: relapsing remitting MS, primary progressive, and secondary progressive MS. And the progressive types of MS are more difficult to treat. And in one of the talks in AAN, Dr. Leora Freeman mentions that physicians are less likely to diagnose patients with SPMS or the secondary progressive MS because treatment options are few, as well as the insurance coverage is limited. As Emma mentioned, many of the studies lack equity, and this holds true for MS as well. The traditional belief was that MS was a whites-only disease, but recent environmental and social changes have accounted for an increased incidence in diverse populations diagnosed with MS. This increased incidence of MS in African Americans and Blacks have pointed that MS is no longer predominantly a white-only disease. This perception had made it increasingly tricky for diverse populations to be diagnosed with MS, and early initiation of treatment had been often delayed in this particular population. Neurologists have also pointed out that many patients have inadequate access to MS specialists, and there is a gap in the health literacy in minority groups. There is also an underrepresentation of African Americans and Blacks in clinical trials. Approximately 38% of trials conducted in MS have not reported the race or ethnicity of the subject, which, if included, could give us a better understanding of the role of genetic predisposition and environmental factors in MS diagnosis and progression. Now, currently, there are no symptoms or physical findings or even laboratory tests that can individually and definitely confirm MS. The physician must use several strategies to determine if MS diagnostic criteria are met. Now, this includes evidence of damage at two separate areas of the CNS and evidence that the damage occurred at different points in time and ruling out all other possible diagnoses. Early diagnosis of MS is crucial as early treatment with disease-modifying therapies or DMTs can minimize relapses and reduce further disability. The 2017 McDonald's criteria is used by physicians to diagnose MS and has increased the number of people diagnosed with MS at an earlier stage of the disease. Since 2017, multiple studies have come out stating the impact of biomarkers on disease progression, as well as enhanced imaging studies in disease diagnosis. Seeing that the McDonald's criteria is set to be revised later this year, a lot of focus in this year's AAN was on biomarkers. Being a neurologist-centered conference, a lot of intriguing studies were also presented. Genetic factors make up to 25% of the risk of MS, among which HLA-DRB11501 accounts for about 10.5% of genetic variants underlying MS. 48% of genetic heritability has now been explained in MS, and more than 200 risk alleles have been identified. The role of Epstein-Barr virus has long been debated in the pathogenesis of MS, but studies have shown that Epstein-Barr virus alone is not sufficient to cause MS. Patients with early childhood Epstein-Barr virus with no episodes of infectious mononucleosis were not at risk of MS, but there was a twofold risk if episodes of infectious mononucleosis occurred in adolescence or adulthood. Diet could also be a key driver, as gut bacteria could influence the immune system. Studies in mice have demonstrated that mice kept in germ-free cages just don't get MS. Disease-modifying therapies, or DMTs, are the mainstay treatment options for MS. DMTs are available most commonly as oral or injectable formulations. Drugs targeting multiple mechanisms of action are available for the treatment of MS. Currently, anti-CD20s are considered among the first choice among neurologists due to their high efficacy and established safety. With MS being a predominantly female disease, selection of DMTs while taking into consideration pregnancy and family planning is essential. DMTs such as teriflunomide contains a black box warning for fetal toxicity and is contraindicated in pregnancy. Older DMTs such as glatiramer acetate are not phytotoxic, and interferons can be used throughout the pregnancy period. As a general rule, oral DMTs, which are smaller molecules, can easily pass through the placenta and could impact fetal development and should be avoided. As children are less likely to be JCV antibody positive in the treatment of pediatric MS, natalizumab, which is seldom used in therapy now due to the risk of PML, can be a safe consideration. Additionally, as children have a developing immune system, B-cell depleting therapies such as anti-CD20s should be used with caution as well.
So you mentioned that biomarkers were a key talking point in AAN. Can you elaborate on the biomarkers of interest that were talked about in MS?
Sure. Among the most relevant biomarkers for MS disease progression, neurofilament light chain has caught the eye of many neurologists. Now, MS occurs due to a damage to the CNS, and NFL is a biomarker of neuroaxonal damage. In one of the studies presented, three biomarkers were evaluated: plasma GFAP, plasma CXCL13, and plasma NFL. DMT use in these patients did not alter the plasma GFAP and plasma CXCL13 at 1 year, but NFL levels were significantly reduced in the high efficacy DMT group at year one. There was also a decrease in B cell, CD19 cells, and CXCR3 cells. In another study, the increase in infiltrating immune cells in the CSF were correlated with NFL in RRMS. The Asclepios 1 and 2 phase 3 trials compared the efficacy of ofatumumab and teriflunomide. This study monitored NFL levels in patients, and these patients were divided into a high NFL group and a low NFL group based on medium NFL levels at baseline. A pre-planned analysis of baseline NFL levels indicated that the biomarker was a prognostic for on-study lesion formation and brain volume loss. Additionally, patients with high NFL at month 3 had a 2.2-fold higher number of T2 lesions and a 3.6-fold higher number of T2 lesions at month 12 as compared to the low NFL group. Although these point to NfL being a promising biomarker for MS disease progression, there are a few concerns among neurologists about NfL though. The concentration of NfL is very low and requires measurement using high precision tools, and these instruments may not be readily available to all facilities. Another factor which needs to be taken into consideration is the correlation of NfL with age. A few other biomarkers have also been looked into. For example, stool GFAP was found to be a sensitive predictor for progressive forms of MS, where a correlation between stool GFAP and a change in EDSS score was established.
What about the trial data? Were there any particularly notable results discussed?
Looking at the treatment side of MS, AAN highlighted results from a few clinical trials evaluating novel mechanisms of action. Study results from the phase 2 trial on nasal ferolumab has shown promise in attenuating microglial activation in patients with non-active SPMS. Ferolumab is a nasally administered anti-CD3 monoclonal antibody developed by Tiziana Life Sciences. In the study, 5 out of 6 patients showed a quantitative reduction in multiple brain lesions. Well, this was, however, a small open-label study enrolling only 6 patients and formed the base for a double-blind, placebo-controlled dose-ranging study of this drug, which is currently ongoing. There is a high unmet need for treatment options in SPMS, and the phase 2 results from the double-blind study give us a better understanding of the safety and efficacy of the drug. Another drug, Sanofi's Frexalimab, targeting CD40L, showed promise in the phase 2 open-label extension trial. The results look optimistic, as 96% of patients on the high-dose Frexalimab were free of gadolinium-enhancing T1 lesions at week 48. The number of gadolinium T1 lesions remained low in participants who continued receiving Frexalimab and continued to decline in those who switched from placebo to Frexalimab at week 12. Now, studies have demonstrated that co-stimulation of CD40 and its ligands have an impact on the functional differentiation of T cells. Frexalimab is the first of the second generation anti-CD40L antibodies designed to specifically avoid lymphocyte depletion and to be studied in MS. Now, Frexalimab does have a tough road ahead though, as there are a number of established treatment options in relapsing MS, and the drug will have to demonstrate excellent safety and efficacy in late stage clinical trials to find a place in the treatment armamentarium. The AAN conference was also an opportunity for established therapies to flex their might. Roche released updated results from the phase 3 Ocarnia trial, which demonstrated the efficacy and safety of subcutaneously administered ocrelizumab in patients with MS. Now, the trial achieved the primary endpoint of non-inferiority with the ocrelizumab IV 600 mg with respect to area under the curve, while also demonstrating a near-complete suppression of relapse activity. Additionally, no new safety signals were identified and was consistent with the well-established safety profile of Ocrevus IV infusion. Now, the introduction of this 10-minute subcutaneous version is expected to greatly improve uptake as a more convenient alternative route with a shorter duration of administration and twice-a-year dosing. The subcutaneous route eliminates the need for additional infrastructure associated with IV administration, thereby having the potential to expand and improve uptake in centers with limitations. Roche has filed for regulatory approval and is expecting a decision later this year. Novartis followed suit with long-term study results from the phase 3 Alethios trial investigating ofatumumab. In recently diagnosed patients, improvements across several efficacy outcomes were seen after switching to ofatumumab, including significant reductions in annualized relapse rate, reduction in MRA lesion activity, and increase in rates of no evidence of disease activity. However, in patients who were initially randomized to teriflunomide and later switched to ofatumumab, rates of 3 and 6 month confirmed disability worsening events remained higher compared to patients receiving continuous ofatumumab, indicating that the efficacy benefit of first line ofatumumab on delaying disability worsening was not fully achieved in the switch group. Now, ofatumumab shares a similar mechanism of action as ocrelizumab, with both targeting CD20 antibodies. Ofatumumab had hoped to be differentiated from ocrelizumab with its self-administered once-monthly sensorially auto-injector pen. However, as Roche is set to roll out the new subcutaneous ocrelizumab, ofatumumab's advantage will likely be rendered you've done.
I see. Well, it sounds like there's been some pretty interesting novel mechanisms of action in the pipeline for MS. The epilepsy space is also seeing some pipeline drugs with different targets. Emma, was there anything particularly interesting discussed at AAN for epilepsy?
So epilepsy is a pretty mature disease area. We have quite a lot of drugs available, and most of them work similarly well. But the epilepsy population is heterogeneous, and even with many therapy options, roughly 30% of people remain unable to properly control their seizures. A lot of the conference coverage was geared more towards physicians and outlined treatment paradigms for special patient groups like neonates or the elderly. But there were a couple of sessions on pipeline treatments. Many of the current drugs are not very specific in their targets, resulting in potentially wide side effect profiles. So drugs in development tend to focus on selective mechanisms. For instance, Xenon's XEN1101 is a Kv7 potassium channel opener with a reasonable tolerability profile that has demonstrated notable efficacy in partial onset seizure. Results from the phase 2b X-TOLE trial read out quite a while ago, back in 2021. But at AAN, there was an interesting presentation on the impact of disease severity on responder rates. This drug was found to be more efficacious in participants with less severe disease, which is interesting given that we oftentimes consider more severe patients to have, you know, more room for improvement. There are a couple phase 3 trials in progress that are anticipated to be completed in mid to late 2025. On the earlier phase side, another potassium channel drug specifically targeting Kv7.2 and 7.3 by Biohaven, BHV7000, was found to be well tolerated in the phase 1 SAD-MAD trial without dose-limiting central nervous side effects seen with other ASMs like somnolence and cognitive or mood disturbances. Like XEN1101, this is in development for focal and generalized epilepsy. However, one of the most interesting approaches presented at AAN was Neurona Therapeutics' first-in-human trial of GABAergic interneuron cell therapy in focal epilepsy. This product is currently known as NRTX1001 and is comprised of a particular type of inhibitive interneuron derived from pluripotent stem cells. This therapy is administered as a single intracerebral dose to the hippocampus, and interim results showed a promising 75% or greater reduction in seizures in 3 of the 5 participants so far.
Wow, that's definitely an interesting approach.
Yeah, and I think Wen, you actually covered a session about accessing stem cell treatment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, there are 2 key points that I would like to highlight in this regard. The first is hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. So historically, autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation is a well-established approach, and it has been shown to exert immune reconstitution effects, such as regeneration of naive B and T cells, thymic reactivation, the emergence of a more diverse T cell receptor repertoire, and restoration of Treg and B regulatory cell levels. While it is a well-established approach to manage severe autoimmune diseases, such as multiple sclerosis, still some patients cannot benefit from this treatment, especially for patients with primary progressive MS. To overcome this obstacle, allogeneic stem cell transplantation, i.e. grafting stem cells from healthy donors, is emerged in hope of replacing the autoreactive immune cells with healthy donor immune cells. The second point I would like to highlight in this regard is medical tourism for stem cell treatment. Stem cell treatment is a major component of medical tourism, especially for those patients who have neurodegenerative diseases and receive limited benefits of conventional therapeutics. Based on a paper published in 2014, the top 3 indications for stem cell therapy are multiple sclerosis, anti-aging, and Parkinson's disease. Although many clinics inside and outside the US offer stem cell treatments, there are actually no FDA-approved regenerative stem cell treatments for these neurological disorders, such as placental or mesenchymal stem cells. As of now, the stem cell treatment that we're talking about is all about the hematopoietic stem cell. While patients are willing to take risks to receive stem cell treatment, they may end up with serious complications such as infections, stroke, or even death. And recently, domestic regulation is actually an ongoing issue with the regard of stem cell treatment. For example, in Texas, Mississippi, and North Carolina, patients suffering from severe chronic diseases or terminal illnesses can receive treatment from physicians using adult stem cell therapies that are already being tested in humans as permitted by state legislations. And more recently, Utah legislation allows healthcare providers to perform a stem cell therapy that is not yet approved by the FDA, as long as they prominently note that it is unapproved and obtained signed patient consent forms. In other words, such a therapy does not require a physician to administer the cells, nor does it require any oversights for manufacturing, safety, cleanliness, or effectiveness. And this law in Utah takes effect on May 1st. So physicians are encouraged to be open-minded and actively engage in discussions with patients, trying to foster the conversations that prioritize scientific evidence and safety. And those physicians can leverage the reliable resources during the discussion, such as aboutstemcells.org or National MS Society.
Wow, that sounds like it was a really interesting discussion.
So what about some of those rarer epilepsies? Was there anything new out of AAN for those?
Yeah, so epilepsy syndromes like Lennox-Gastaut, Dravet, SCN2A-related epilepsies, and CDKL5 deficiency disorder have been getting some more attention recently. Well, not exactly new, since these results were already released earlier this year. The phase 1b/2a Pacific study revealed that Longboard Pharmaceuticals' bexicaserin, a highly selective 5-HT2C receptor agonist, had a reasonably benign safety profile and showed promising reduction in countable motor seizures in patients with developmental and epileptic encephalopathies, such as the aforementioned syndromes.
Whilst we're on the topic of rare diseases, when you attended a couple of conference sessions on myelin, oligodendrocyte, glycoprotein, antibody disorders, what sort of research progress have we seen in this space?
Sure. Myelin, oligodendrocyte, glycoprotein, antibody disorders, in short, MOGAD, is a difficult disease because it is hard to diagnose these patients and there is no effective approved treatment at the moment. So MOGAD is a rare inflammatory disease that affects the central nervous system. Patients' autoantibody MOG-IgG triggers immune system attacking myelin, which is a lipid wrap of neuron dendrite facilitating signal transmission. The attack of myelin causes demyelination and therefore results in clinical symptoms including vision loss, muscle weakness, stiffness or paralysis, confusion, seizures, and headaches, etc. And these symptoms can be very confused with other diseases such as multiple sclerosis. So it was not until last year that a proposed diagnostic criteria was published. So in that paper, patients have to have demyelination symptoms, as I mentioned earlier, and also these patients have to be tested positive with MOG-IgG antibody in a cell-based assay. Before making the final diagnosis, physicians have to exclude alternative diagnoses such as multiple sclerosis. Of note, MOG-IgG screening is not feasible because the presence of MOG-IgG can be observed in other diseases such as stroke, thereby resulting in false positive diagnosis. So, as mentioned earlier, there's no approved treatment for MOG patients. All the treatment options are off-label use, including corticosteroids, intravenous immunoglobulin IVIG to dilute the pathogenic MOG-IgG, anti-CD20 antibody to eliminate B cells, as well as plasma exchange. Nowadays, there are more pipeline drugs under clinical development, including interleukin-6 receptor inhibitor in a phase 3 study as well as FcRn inhibitors. Based on the advancement of CAR T cell therapy in autoimmune diseases, CAR T cell therapy may also be a promising option for treating MOGAD patients in the future.
Okay, so we know CAR T mostly in the context of treating cancer patients, but what are the potential risks when using CAR T cell therapy to treat patients with autoimmune neurological diseases?
Yeah, most of the CAR T cell therapy experiences were derived from cancer treatment. Yet this therapy is actively being tested in patients with autoimmune diseases. And this field is further encouraged by a paper published this year in New England Journal of Medicine by a Germany group. In that paper, there were a total of 15 patients with severe systemic lupus erythematosus, SLE, idiopathic inflammatory myositis, or systemic sclerosis, receiving a single infusion of CD19 CAR T cells. And all these patients experienced significant disease improvement with favorable safety profiles. This paper really marks the potential of CAR T cell therapy in autoimmune neurological disorders. And yet, the efficacy may come with risks. The most prominent risks for CAR T therapy include CRS and ICANS. CRS stands for cytokine release syndrome. It usually occurs 2 to 3 days after the first infusion, and patients will be characterized with fever, hypotension, or respiratory insufficiency. And luckily, this CRS can be managed with interleukin receptor inhibitor. In addition, the second type of side effect occurring in the CAR T therapy is ICANS, which termed immune effector cell associated neurotoxicity syndrome. ICANS usually takes place during or after CRS resolution. Patients would usually be characterized with seizure, agitation, and motor weakness, and so on. ICANS is a more complex challenge, and it cannot be resolved with interleukin-6R inhibitor. From a phase 2 study, interleukin-1 receptor inhibitor, Anakinra, may have a promising role in preventing ICANS. There are several risk factors associated with ICANS based on the experience in treating cancers. For example, from the perspective of host or tumor factors, tumor burdens or pre-existing inflammation levels will be positively correlated with the ICANS frequency. In addition, there are also some therapy-related factors. For example, the CAR T cell dose with a higher amount of cells being injected into patients. Those patients would tend to have an increased risk of ICANS. Importantly, patients with prior severe CRS also tend to have an increased risk of severe ICANS. So in brief, effective management of neurotoxicities will be essential for optimizing patient survival and quality of life. We may also see a rapid growth for safer CARs design for CNS tumors as well as autoimmune diseases in the near future.
I think it's so exciting to see treatments progress across different therapy areas that can really help streamline research and flesh out safety profiles. Now, I think we should move on and chat about Parkinson's disease. Summer, what were some of the main topics of discussion on this front at AAN?
Yeah, so the focus in Parkinson's disease is still on better diagnosing and monitoring patients, as well as developing disease-modifying therapies that are primarily targeting alpha-synuclein, which plays a critical role in the pathogenesis of PD. The majority of talks at AAN were aimed at educating physicians about diagnosing and treating Parkinson's, but it was also interesting to hear firsthand from physicians and in some cases from patients themselves about their experiences. And there was a lot of focus on non-motor and prodromal symptoms in Parkinson's disease and how these should be treated, which is a big unmet need in this area. Prodromal symptoms of PD refer to the stage at which individuals do not fulfill diagnostic criteria for PD. But understanding prodromal PD is important as it represents an opportunity for early recognition of incipient PD and therefore could allow for the initiation of potential neuroprotective therapies at a stage where these therapies might be the most effective. So prodromal markers of PD include hyposmia, constipation, mood changes, and REM sleep behaviour disorder. There was one speaker from the University of Washington who described the spectrum of autonomic dysfunction in PD. She particularly focused on orthostatic hypertension, which is estimated to be present in 10 to 50% of PD patients, and also gastrointestinal dysfunction, which affects about 60 to 80% of PD patients. So although not FDA approved in this indication, the speakers described that fludrocortisone and atomoxetine are sometimes used to treat OH. And there are no head-to-head trials comparing medications for OH, but an individualized approach is used based on pre-existing comorbidity. And one limitation of treating OH is that medications can cause supine hypertension, which is evident in about 34 to 46% of PD patients. And additionally, if a patient is taking carbidopa, levodopa for motor symptoms in PD, this can actually lead to the worsening of orthostatic hypertension. And there was another speaker who outlined the neuropsychiatric manifestations of PD, which includes anxiety, psychosis, impulse control disorders, delusions, dementia and apathy. And she explained the differences between Parkinson's disease dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So PD dementia patients tend to have better long-term memory and language than Alzheimer's disease patients, but worse executive dysfunction and visual spatial skills. But the two sets of patients do tend to have comparable short-term memory. But cognitive decline in PD remains pretty disabling and difficult to treat. Rivastigmine is a cholestomerase inhibitor, which is FDA approved for PDD. And Donnay's pill is also likely to be effective, but there's not very much evidence on this. And the speaker actually noted that she has found the rivastigmine patch better than the rivastigmine pill, and additionally stated that Donnay's pill is better tolerated than the rivastigmine pill. There was also an industry session for Supernus. Dr. Robert Hauser spoke, who actually invented the Hauser diary in the early 2000s, which is still used today in clinical trials to track motor fluctuations, which are the kind of tremor and rigidity, which are the most well-known signs of Parkinson's disease. And he also coined the term troublesome and non-troublesome dyskinesia. So for those who don't know, dyskinesias are the twisting and turning movements that develop over time in Parkinson's patients, normally due to levodopa treatment, but Parkinson's patients taking levodopa normally cycle in waves between having dyskinesia so at the top of the wave, and then having on time when the medication is working, and then having off time at the bottom of the wave when the treatment is not working at all. So in this session, he was discussing Supernus's Gocovri, which is a extended release amantadine treatment, which is the only FDA-approved treatment for dyskinesia. And he described Gocovri as widening the therapeutic window by reducing excessive glutamatergic activity, which increases the on time by reducing both dyskinesia and off time, which differs from dopaminergic treatments, which just increase on time by reducing off time. And in one of the Q&A sessions, that an audience member actually said she was having trouble getting other medications such as Ritalin and Imbruvica covered by insurance. And she asked the speaker how she manages to get any medication aside from immediate release carbidopa, levodopa covered. And the speaker said that she keeps an ongoing list of medications tried and failed for each of her patients. And she writes down, for example, why she thinks a certain medication would be appropriate for her patient or not appropriate, so why she hasn't tried certain medications. And she will also keep written records of off symptoms and dyskinesias. And she said these are the factors that insurance companies are looking for when deciding whether to reimburse. And finally, the future of diagnosing Parkinson's disease was also a big topic throughout this conference. So speakers agreed that a further understanding of non-white populations is needed. Several studies have indicated that African Americans are less likely to be diagnosed with Parkinson's or are presented later to the clinic than Caucasian Americans. And one speaker explained that she expects neuroimaging beyond the striatum to allow for earlier diagnosis in the future. And there's also a lot of current research focused on biomarkers, but there are no current recommendations for use of these biomarkers in clinical diagnosis yet. So diagnosis for Parkinson's is still based upon symptoms that a person is experiencing, although the alpha-synuclein seed amplification assay can now be used to detect misfolded alpha-synuclein aggregates in the CSF. And she also expects skin biopsies to become more common for diagnosis. So in a different presentation, a speaker from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center discussed the SYN1 test, which is sold by CND Life Sciences, which uses a skin biopsy to look for atypical clumps of alpha-synuclein, which may help both in confirming and diagnosing and also guiding treatment options for people being evaluated for Parkinson's. So in this talk, he provided an overview of how the test has impacted decision making for 97 patients who were evaluated in his clinic in Boston between 2021 and 2022. And two-thirds of these patients had a change in their diagnosis after undergoing the SYN1 test. And more than half experienced a change in treatment.
It sounds like there were a lot of good tidbits in the diagnosis and treatment paradigm talks. Were there any interesting studies presented?
So there wasn't top-line data as such, but there was a lot of interesting studies. So Roche presented data from the open-label extension study for its potentially disease-modifying antibody, prasinezumab. So the four-year extension from the phase 2 Pasadena trial was compared to an external PPMI cohort. So PPMI is the Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative, which is a longitudinal observational study designed to identify PD progression biomarkers. So it's compared to this data set, and it showed that prasinezumab treated individuals progressed less than untreated PPMI individuals on clinical rated motor examination and on patient reported motor experiences of daily living. There are also some subgroup analysis regarding phase 3 trial for AbbVie 951, which is a subcutaneous infusion of fos levodopa. One analysis showed that improvements in on and off time with AbbVie 951 were not significantly different between subgroups. So subgroups were age, sex, race, nationality, PD duration, and a similar subgroup results were presented actually for Neuroderm's competing subcutaneous product NDO612. Another subgroup analysis of the phase three AbbVie 951 trial showed that the treatment actually improved sleep in Parkinson's patients. And so on a preclinical note, Dr. Abby Olson from Pittsburgh Institute of Neurodegenerative Diseases presented an interesting study suggesting potential new glial-based therapeutic targets for Parkinson's treatments. So her group undertook a large genetic screen and metabolomic study in fruit flies and knocked down the entire genome, which is 360 kinases in the glia. And they measured adenosine after the knockdown of five different genes identified in the screen and observed an increase in adenosine, as well as a rescue of neurodegeneration. And the speaker explained that understanding how the adenosine pathway works is essential to future trial design, particularly whether it's adenosine that is neuroprotective or urate, because adenosine is actually metabolized down to urate. And the investigators constantly knock down every gene in glia that is involved in the metabolism of adenosine down to urate. And they found that the knockdown of adenosine deaminases reduces leg motion, whereas knockdown of downstream genes do not, suggesting that it is the adenosine itself that is responsible for neuroprotection. And the AK1 gene in particular was suggested to be a good therapeutic target. So although adenosine itself may not be the best biomarker of dysfunctional adenosine metabolism, xanthine, urate and their derivatives are more promising in terms of pattern of change in absolute levels.
So there was also quite a bit of coverage regarding atypical Parkinsonian syndromes and other movement disorders. What stood out to you most?
So starting with multiple system atrophy, so MSA, the clinical diagnosis of MSA is still pretty challenging and delayed. Prodromal MSA patients do not respond to levodopa or other dopaminergic medications. One speaker explained that a patient is more likely to phenoconvert from isolated autonomic behaviour into MSA as opposed to convert into PD or dementia of the Lewy bodies if they have early onset of orthostatic hypertension, so around the age of 50, or preserved olfactory function, whereas patients who phenoconvert to Parkinson's disease or dementia of the Lewy bodies tend to have later onset of orthostatic hypotension, so the mid to late 60s, and impaired olfactory function, and often combined with probable REM sleep behavior disorder as well. And when tested in the same cell lines, MSA versus PD patient alpha-synuclein strains differ. They display differing abilities to seed. And a phase two trial is ongoing for Arteritis ATH434, which is a novel inhibitor of alpha-synuclein, which is actually potentially disease modifying. And more treatment options are needed for other similar atypical anti-Parkinson syndrome, so progressive supranuclear palsy and corticobasal degeneration. The presence of exavial alpha-synuclein distinguishes Parkinson's from these syndromes, and patients with the diseases also do not respond well to levodopa, and dopaminergic medications and MOAB inhibitors are recommended against. However, these medications are often used and tried because of the lack of treatment options. And there's also an industry update from Alexion regarding its two FDA-approved treatments for NMOSD, which is neuromyelitis optical spectrum disorder. And these are both monoclonal antibodies. And the speaker explained that many patients are being switched from Soliris, which was approved in 2019, to Ultomiris, which was approved earlier this year, basically due to an improvement in dosing convenience. And NMOSD patient taking Soliris was actually invited onto stage to talk about her experience. And she explained that she'd been misdiagnosed with multiple sclerosis for 4 years and how this has had a devastating effect on her health and her independence. And the speaker actually confirmed how common it is for NMOSD patients to be initially diagnosed with MS. He emphasised the importance of testing for NTAQP4 antibodies for correct diagnosis, particularly considering MS medications can actually worsen NMOSD symptoms. And there was also an update from the CEO of Prilina Therapeutics regarding predopridine, which activates the sigma-1 receptor. And this is in for the treatment of Huntington's disease. And the drug had previously failed to reach the primary endpoint in the phase 3 PROOF-HD study. So these results are already released. But in this study, patients were allowed to take anti-dopaminergic medications alongside the investigational treatment if necessary. But other studies have actually suggested that anti-dopaminergic medications are associated with more rapidly progressive Huntington's disease. So this speaker focused on a subgroup of patients in this trial, which was those not taking the ADMs, which showed that predopridine significantly improved or stabilised all outcome measures for at least 1 year and was better than placebo up to week 78 for all endpoints. So the first regulatory submission for predopridine in Huntington's disease is planned for mid-2024.
I believe there were also a number of sessions on myasthenia gravis, as a number of new drugs have been approved for this disease. When new, could you tell us a little bit about the AA coverage of this neuromuscular condition?
Sure. MG area is actually an exciting area where there are plenty of new drugs being approved to treat this disease. So basically in AAN conference, MG sessions are more informative and educational to provide information for those first-line clinicians. So myasthenia gravis is actually an autoimmune neuromuscular junction disease, meaning that this disease impacts junctions between neurons and muscles. Therefore, muscles cannot respond well to the commands from neurons. So patients are usually characterized by muscle weakness and muscle fatigue because they cannot control their muscles voluntarily. And this is resulted from the autoimmune responses by the generation of autoantibodies. And these autoantibodies usually target acetylcholine receptors and muscle-specific tyrosine kinase located in these neuromuscular junctions. In addition, these autoantibodies may further trigger complement activation, therefore exaggerating the disease in a very progressive way. So currently, there are several treatments for the MG, including conventional treatments as well as surgeries. For the conventional drug treatments, there are acetylcholine esterase inhibitor, pyrostigmine, to enrich the neurotransmitters, as well as immunosuppressants, steroids, or non-steroid drugs. For the surgery, there is thymectomy, which is a surgical removal of thymus gland. And nowadays, there are two types of new drugs being approved, including complement inhibitors and FcRn inhibitors. So there are three drugs for the complement inhibition, including eculizumab, ravulizumab, and zilucoplan. These drugs are aimed to minimize immune responses in patients. While inhibition of complement is effective in treating MG patients, let's not forget that complement is also an important immune defense against certain bacterial infections. Inhibition of complements may result in serious infections such as Neisseria meningitidis. Therefore, before taking complement inhibitors, patients should be pre-vaccinated against meningococcal infection or prophylactic antibiotics when necessary. The other important new therapy is FcRn inhibitor. FcRn is neonatal Fc receptor, which binds immunoglobulins, IgG, and saves them from lysosome degradation. Therefore, FcRn inhibition accelerates the clearance of IgG, including those pathogenic autoantibodies. And these FcRn inhibitors include efgartigimod and rozanolixizumab. And more FcRn inhibitors are in the late stage development. So in this session, presenters analyzed the pros and cons of each class of the drugs. For example, pyrostigmine is cheap, but it is not very effective. Steroids are cheap, but it is pretty toxic when the drug is used in the long term. However, the newer drugs, the complement inhibitors and FcRn inhibitors, are pretty efficacious, but it really takes a lot of time for the physicians to prepare for paperwork to get a nod from insurance companies. Therefore, insurance reimbursement is a real-world barrier for patients to get these drugs. And in addition to FcRn inhibitors, there are more pipeline drugs being developed in the clinical stage, such as B-cell directed therapy by anti-CD19 antibodies, as well as CAR T cell therapies, including CD19 and BCMA CAR T cells. Finally, the presenters emphasized that yet there is a small subset of MG patients who are not well served with these new therapies. And those patients are ocular myasthenia gravis. So generally, 85% of myasthenia gravis patients will have ocular symptoms, such as droopy eyelids and double vision. And 15% of MG patients remain restricted to the ocular muscles. Although the ocular symptoms are not life-threatening, these symptoms really impact patients' daily life and work. And steroids are pretty effective for treating these patients, but again, the long-term use could result in very severe toxicities. And however, in all the clinical trials for the new treatments, these OMG patients are excluded. Therefore, this population presents a really important unmet need in the MG drug landscape.
Wow, AAN really covered a lot of ground this year. It sounds like there's been a lot of exciting advancements in clinical research within the neurology space. Moving slightly away from that side of things now, though, of course, diversity, equity, and inclusion have started to become really important areas of focus in healthcare as well, especially within recent years. Emma, can you speak a little bit on the coverage of this at AAN?
So I was really impressed with the breadth of diversity covered at AAN. Many of the conferences I've been to in the past have had discussion on racial and ethnic diversity in clinical trial populations, But AAN went a few steps farther and not only had multiple sessions on how neurological disorders present in different populations, including the LGBTQIA+ community, but also highlighted the importance of diversity on the provider and researcher sides as well. There were resources for providers on cultural competency, discussions on the interplay between hormones and disorders like epilepsy and migraine, and even a number of longer sessions on the social determinants of brain health and how different types of inequity contribute to overall health. The AAN has also added a DEI statement to its mission. It was actually quite refreshing to see a large, influential organization like AAN move towards practicing what it preaches and give these important topics such a primary platform during the conference.
Definitely. How do you think that emphasis at AAN reflects broader trends in the healthcare industry as a whole?
I mean, before we actively started including women in clinical trials, drugs would be approved based on data from men. And then, lo and behold, when women took the drug post-approval, sometimes we'd see efficacy and safety concerns that were inconsistent with those from the trial. Similarly, the recent push for intentionally including patients of different ethnic backgrounds has allowed us to better represent the patient population the drug may someday be serving. The FDA's 2020 guidance on ways to increase enrollment of underrepresented populations has provided a pretty good base framework, and I think we'll continue to see this more and more thoroughly reflected in clinical trial populations in the years to come.
I look forward to seeing that happen. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you to Summer, Joseph, and Menu for sharing their insights on the cutting-edge research presented at AAN 2024.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. We'll be back next month with more insights on groundbreaking pharmaceutical topics from our subject matter experts here at Data Monitor Healthcare.